I've turned the tape recorder on. Dr. Rubini, is it okay if we tape record this conversation?
Yes, it is.
Great. We'll go around the room announcing who we are, and then you might mention who's on your side of the call. I'll start. My name is Bruce McWilliams. I'm an investigator here at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
This is Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm part of the writing team here at the FCIC in Washington.
I'm Kirsten Downey, also part of the writing team.
Stephen Mintz, part of the writing team.
And Gary Cohen, I'm the general counsel of the commission.
Gary, do you want to announce about the tape recording or the what we're going to do with the recording?
Sure. Dr. Rubini, this is both information for us for use as we prepare the report, and also we're collecting a lot of these interviews with leading figures in economics and finance and other participants in the crisis to become part of our oral history project, as it were. And these will be posted, these interviews, the audio files, will be posted on the internet when we release our report so that future historians, you know, 200, 300, 400, 500 years from now, can see what the people who were on the ground thought about things as they were going along. So if that's okay with you, we'd like permission as well to post this interview along with the other interviews that we've collected.
That would be fine with me.
Okay, thank you very much. Open it up. You should let us know, besides yourself, who you've got with you.
There's only myself on the call.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Dr. Rubini, I've read parts of your book, and I've read parts of the articles I've read in the newspapers and magazines and such. But let me just ask you sort of a general, sort of open-ended question. What do you think caused the financial crisis?
Big question.
In my view, there was not only one factor, there were many of them. And, you know, I wrote an entire book that was published this past spring, Crisis Economics, in which I discuss the causes of the crisis and evolution of the crisis. I tried to make a long list, and it's not in order of importance or relative importance, but I would say that certainly monetary policy was too loose, with the Fed cutting the Fed funds rate after 2001 too much and keeping it too low for too long and tightening it too slowly. So easy monetary policy certainly fed the housing bubble. Secondly, I would say there was a bit of a overall attitude towards the regulation and supervision of the financial system that I would characterize as regulators and supervisors being, asleep at the wheel. There was this ideology that markets know best, that it's better to rely on on self-regulation or self-supervision, on market discipline, on internal risk management models, on principle rather than rules. And I think that approach miserably failed for a number of reasons. And Basel II was obsolete even before it was implemented. Three, I would say that there's been large literature on agency problems in the financial system, in the corporate sector, but especially in the financial system, that suggest why corporate governance in the financial institution, together with incentives related to compensation, lead to excessive risk-taking, excessive debt and leverage in the financial system. So call it generically greed, arrogance, stupidity, you name it, among bankers, traders, and financial institutions. I think that was part of the problem. And a subset of it was the significant also conflicts of interest that individual financial institutions, like, rating agency had, given that a large part of their revenues and profit increasingly came from structured finance. Additionally, I would say that financial liberalization had led to the financial system in many dimensions was more opaque and less transparent than before, with new, exotic, complex, toxic, mark-to-model rather than mark-to-market new instruments that were not properly priced being introduced that created lack of transparency. There was an international dimension of what we saw with the, the glut of savings coming from China and other emerging markets, keeping long-term interest rates low in the United States, even after the Fed tightened rates. The Chinese provided us the goods for us to overspend to our income and provide us the financing that made this bubble last, longer than otherwise. I would put some role, but not as much of a role, on the existence of policy incentives to housing. CRA and that kind of things, Fannie and Freddie have been around for decades. So I don't. I think that there is some role played by that, but I don't think it was crucial why the bubble became so severe. In this last decade when these incentives to housing had been around for decades. So it played some role, but in my view, that was not central. And most of the subprime securitization started as a private label securitization. Fannie and Freddie actually were out of it for quite a while. So there were mistakes were made also by Fannie and Freddie, and eventually they got in trouble. But I would say it was exactly because of the constraint imposed on Fannie and Freddie that most of the financial innovation in terms of new structural finance for subprime mortgages occurred outside of the GSEs in the private sector. So to me, that factor was not necessarily critical, even if, of course, even Fannie and Freddie ended up going bust. So it's not one factor, it's a combination of them together, and different people have different views on the importance of different factors, but all of them have had a role.
When you had mentioned earlier, you thought that, I didn't catch the quote because I didn't write down, but you said something about either stupid or incorrect decisions or activities taken by individuals and financial institutions. Were they wrong decisions on an individual basis that collectively became, were they right decisions rather on an individual basis that collectively added up to a wrong decision? Or were they individually wrong as well for their own benefit?
Well, in my view, it's a combination. There is a whole set of agency problems in financial institutions. There's a huge literature in corporate finance about the principal agent problems in any corporate setup that suggests that, sometimes principals, shareholders could not fully monitor, given asymmetric information, the action of managers. In financial institutions, that asymmetric information problem, principal agent, is more severe because, every individual banker and trader is essentially a separate P&L, and no imperial CEO or even board can fully monitor the individual actions of individual traders and bankers. And so there is a traditional principal agent problem that is exacerbated then by the way compensation occurs that leads to maximize short-term revenues and profits, even if it eventually leads to risk for the institution. But that's only one of the problems. The other problem is not just the managers that were biased, but even the CEOs had pressures to take excessive risk, right? The famous Chuck Spring statement, when the music is playing, you got to stand up and dance, implies that, shareholders themselves were imposing pressure on the managers to take too much leverage and risk. Why that's the case, it's in part the kind of like the other moral hazard problem derives from the fact that if you don't have enough equity in the financial institutions, then even the shareholders don't have enough of a skin in the game, and therefore even shareholders, let alone any agency problems of the managers, will have an incentive to take too much risk, borrow other people's money, especially if the other people's money is effectively a good chunk of it deposit guaranteed by the government, and take too much risk and leverage. So that's another kind of agency problem. And the third agency problem is that in modern financial institutions, the ultimate shareholders are not really controlling these institutions, but they're delegating essentially control mostly to institutional investors that are those who are sitting on the board of these institutions, and the financial interests of these institutional investors are not necessarily the same as those of the final shareholders. There is a wide range of conflicts of interest involved the relationship between those who are institutional investors who are sitting on the boards of these institutions together with CEOs and managers of these institutions. So there is like a double or triple agency problem. So there are layers of corporate governance issues that have not been resolved, that have became worse with financial innovation and with the system of compensation of traders, bankers, CEOs, and you name it. So it's a whole set of failures of corporate governance that are there at the core of the problem. That started with, in my view, when investment banks became public companies rather than being partnerships, and therefore the internal kind of monitoring of the behavior of individual partners started to fail. And that becoming public companies put pressure on maximizing short-term return on equities by maximizing leverage, and the behavior of these broker dealers then forced traditional banks that were losing also market access to then become themselves more leveraged and more risk-taking. So I think that the repeal of Glass-Steagall actually was actually a massive mistake.
Some people have said that Glass-Steagall was pretty much an anachronism by the time they repealed it, because there were so many loopholes and ways around it already. But you did mention the changes in the investment bank's structure from partnerships to corporations. So do you think that's when this agency problem became a bigger issue? Because it doesn't seem like it always was the case, certainly not in the 50s or the 60s.
Yeah, no, I agree that, by the time Glass-Steagall was formally repealed, there were so many loopholes that was the final acknowledgement of it. So it was a process that lasted, over a decade of slowly chipping in at it. I would say that certainly the move from private partnership to public companies created a variety of, agency problems that did not exist before. That was, a critical factor. Some people say, that Europe and Japan had universal banks for a long time and was not a problem, but I think that once U.S. Broker-dealers became public and became very aggressive in their behavior, even traditionally more prudent, dodgy, and less risk-taking European and Japanese and other advanced economies broker-dealers were forced to play the same game, and at the same time, traditional banks that were also more prudent, with the emergence of largely unregulated and supervised broker-dealers and other members of the shadow banking system, felt again the pressure to essentially become more risk-taking. So it was a whole, evolution that took, of course, two or three decades that led to this fundamental change in the financial system with the rise of the shadow banking system and the transformation of broker dealers and other financial institutions in a direction that led to increasing leverage, risk-taking, and maximization of short-term return on equity.
A lot of the we've conducted a lot of interviews and done a lot of hearings in Washington and around the country, and an awful lot of executives, top executives, top Wall Street executives, and regulators have told us that this was like a perfect storm. There was no way of knowing this was going to happen, that it just hit from out of the blue. What do you think about that?
Well, I disagree. If you read the several chapters of my book, I put this financial crisis in the context of previous financial crises. We've had them for centuries. There are many similarities and there are also many differences among them, but actually the first chapter of my book is titled White Swan, and it's titled White Swan is a reference to, you know, the Nassim Taleb idea of a black swan,
yes.
Meaning, you know, one is that financial crises are random events like an earthquake that you cannot predict, that come out of nowhere. There is a distribution, there is a fat tail, and some events that should be occurring once in 100 years then occur. The reality is that, first of all, crises are not black swan events, but they are the predictable outcome of a build-up of macro policy and financial vulnerabilities. The exact timing of the tipping point or the Minsky moment might not be easy, but they're always the build-up of these vulnerabilities. Hundreds of years of history suggest and similarity among them suggest. And therefore, they're not just random events that are a perfect storm that is unpredictable. But, you know, people have short memories. They always forget about past crises, first of all. You know, today's traders are too young to even remember the 2001 recession and crises, let alone those that occurred in 1991 or decades earlier. And two, you know, the system of incentive is such that even if you read the financial history and you know it all, if your incentive is to maximize risk in the short run, you're going to keep on repeating the same mistake. It doesn't matter. So one, you don't have memory. Two, even if you have memory, you know, the incentive schemes are such that we keep on repeating the same mistakes. So the idea that these are random perfect storm events is just nonsense. And there are hundreds of years of financial history, hundreds of papers and study about financial crises, about banking crises. They look at all the factors and the long list of them that lead to this financial crisis. So they're not just random events that come out of nowhere. That's total nonsense.
I did want to follow up on it. You were, though, one of the people who was in a position to be saying things that were going against the common wisdom. Could you elaborate a little bit? Obviously, you spoke to people and you told them your views. Could you elaborate a little bit about how you were treated by people who had the position, who had positions of power, who could have intervened in those years?
Before you answer that, one of the questions that the chairman actually had an interest in was, when did you first see the warning signs, and how early was it, and what did you see? And then you can share with us how what reaction you got to the warning signs that you saw and spoke about.
Let's put it away. You know, I mean, first of all, as you know, there were a number of people, maybe a minority, but it was not just me, that pointed out that you know, many of these risk and vulnerability, and there's a long list of them I cite also in my book, and I connected many of these dots myself. And to me, the most interesting question is not why in any crisis there are a few people, analysts, academic individuals, who are warning about it, but rather because why they are ignored by everybody else. And I think it has to do with the kind of irrational exuberance that exists when there is a bubble and everybody believing in a bubble. You know, I was more sensitive to this question because I spent the last, you know, 15 years of my academic career studying financial crises. You know, I was one of the early who analyzed the Asian financial crisis and emerging market financial crisis, and wrote a whole book in 2004 titled Bailouts versus Bail-ins, Responding to Financial Crisis in Emerging Markets. And therefore, you know, I was more aware than others about those kinds of macroeconomic and financial vulnerabilities eventually lead to a trigger point. I've been studying these things for decades, and that was one of my specialties. You know, even the courses that I was teaching at NYU Stern were titled, you know, recent experience from financial crisis and so on. So I was attuned to that to begin with, I would say, more than others were. And as I said, there are many similarities between crises. In particular, one of the similarities in every crisis, there is a period in which there is an asset and a credit boom that leads leads then eventually to an asset and a credit bubble, followed then by, you know, the inevitable bust and crash. So those are things that, you know, you can see in patterns of financial crisis across history, advanced economies, emerging markets, and so on. And of course, there is a distinction between, you know, banking crisis, broader financial crisis, currency crisis, sovereign debt crisis, systemic corporate and household debt crisis. You know, some of them overlap, some of them don't. There's a whole classification about them. You know, to me, let's put it this way, when I warned about the bust in housing and the coming then financial crisis and recession, US and globally, in the summer of 2006, to me it was obvious that the timing was exactly right for the following reason. Many people had warned about a housing bubble in the United States already starting in 2002, 3, 4, and 5. But if you had called for the bust a year earlier, you would have been wrong, because one of the features of bubbles is that as long as the bubble continues, then, you know, as long as demand outstrips supply of any asset, then prices can go higher and the bubble can continue. And you need the oxygen of rising prices to feed the bubble, especially when the speculative demand is one of the drivers of that particular bubble. In the spring and summer of, say, 04 or 05, home prices were still rising, housing starts were still rising, housing sales, both existing and new, were still rising. So we were still on the, how to say, on the upper leg of a bubble. But by May, June of 2006, prices had started flattening, housing starts had started to fall after reaching an unprecedented peak, and new and existing home sales were also starting to fall. So when I started to call for the bust of housing, I knew I was right, because we were at the top of that bubble. And unless those quantitative prices keep on rising, you cannot have the bubble fitting on itself. So that was the reason why the time was correct.
How did you know it was the top?
If you look at the data, if you look at the chart, time series of housing starts, new and existing home sales, and prices, you see that the first derivative initially was positive, and the second derivative was also positive. Everything was accelerating. Then the second derivative became negative, while the first became positive. And by May, June of 2006, even the first derivative was becoming zero and started to become negative, meaning not only the quantity, supply and demand and prices were flattening out, but they were starting actually contract. That had not happened for the previous 10 years. Okay. So you knew that the bubble was over, because prices were starting to flatten, if not fall, and quantities were starting to essentially fall. So it was obvious that we were at the peak of that particular bubble. The data essentially were telling us. So it was not a particular, how to say, forecasting ability. The data suggested it was the beginning of the downturn. So that. And secondly, in terms of effect of it, you know, at that time I said home prices are going to fall at least 20%, supply and demand is going to fall at least 50% from the peak. At that time, people thought I was a lunatic, because they said these things have never occurred before. But to me, that was actually pretty also easy to forecast, because, first of all, home prices in real term had doubled between 96 and 2006. And if you look at the second edition of Bob Shiller's Irrational Exuberance, real home prices for the last 120 years had been flat in the United States. Has been flat because whenever prices go higher, there is more supply because there is plenty of land, and the cost of building home is equal to increases by the CPI because it's materials. So there is no reason why real home prices, meaning home prices divided by CPI, should be trending upwards, and they've never trended upwards. They've been flat, like a flat electrocardiogram for 120 years. Of course, there were bubbles up and down of 20% plus or minus around them, but it's flat, the real home price. And it says real home prices doubled between 1996 and 2006. So first of all, it was obvious it was a bubble. And secondly, mean reversion implied that they should fall in real terms by about 50% just to go back to the previous mean. And that implied that with inflation, say, cumulative of 10%, you needed a nominal price fall of at least 30% to essentially correct real home prices to their own fundamental value. I was cautious and I was saying 20%. It turned out to be 30% from the peak. And I was actually over-optimistic because from the peak, starts and sales fell 80%, and from the peak, home prices fell 30%, not 20%. So the biggest bear on housing turned out to be too optimistic, actually, compared to what happened. But of course, at that time, people thought I was crazy. But so if you look at the numbers, just pure mean reversion would suggest that you get those price effects and quantities. And two, the real economic effects were also obvious because a relatively minor housing bubble in the late 80s, when we had the SNL bubble, when home prices increased relative to the mean only by 10-15%, even that minor correction was only 5%, led to a pretty nasty recession that lasted about 8 months between 1990 in 1991, and it led to a severe, if limited, banking crisis, the SNL one. And in this case, real home prices had doubled, and I expect at least a 20% correction. And you plug in a correction that's four times as big as the previous one, and you get a recession that's four times as big and a much bigger financial crisis. So when I predicted that we'll have a nasty recession by 2007 and a severe banking crisis, it was just an inference from comparing a previous small bubble and its bust and what it led, and say, if this bigger bubble is going to go bust, what's going to happen to the real economy, to the banking system, to Fannie and Freddie? And then since when U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold, in this case it would be not just sneezing but pneumonia, of course, then you'll have a global recession in due time. So all those predictions that in the summer of 2006 looked like a bit nutty were predicated on actually quite a sensible inferences based on previous crises and previous bubbles in housing going bust and what they would lead.
Right.
So they were actually pretty carefully made.
Now, where did you say these things and to what audiences?
Well, you know, I wrote first on my blog on it in July and August of 2006. Then I gave that speech, by now it's famous, around early September at the IMF. And then I started writing about it, you know, daily. And, you know, I was in touch with lots of people. But I think, you know, the reaction of most people was, yeah, there was a housing bubble. Yes, there is going to be some deflation of it. Housing is only 6% of GDP. Therefore, a housing bust and a minor one cannot lead to an economy-wide recession or crisis, forgetting that, you know, in six out of the last nine U.S. recessions, housing bust was associated with a recession. So, you know, the usual argument is, you know, either there's not a bubble, it's a minor bubble, it's going to be a deflation of a bubble, it's going to be a minor housing correction or a larger correction, or if it's a larger correction, it doesn't have economy-wide effects, or if it has effects, it's going to be contained to the financial system in terms of losses. You know, the usual things that people say to say that, yeah, there may be some trouble, but it's going to be contained. That was the reaction of most people in the official sector.
Did you discuss it with anyone at the Fed or the banking regulatory agencies?
Not at the regulatory agencies. I did not personally speak with folks at the Fed. You know, I had a meeting at some point with some folks senior at the U.S. Treasury. This was towards, you know, maybe early 2007. But, you know, my writings were widely read, you know, by lots of people. So
even though they were widely written, widely circulated, no one from the regulatory agencies called you and said, can you come in and talk more about this?
Well, I mean, my view is, you know, I mean, there is always people that warn about, you know, about an impending crisis. I think that whenever there is a bubble, I think people live in a bubble. U.S. consumers for a number of years could consume more than their income because they're using their homes as ATM machines, and not just their homes, but their credit cards and auto loans and you name it. So they were happy because they could consume more. Politicians were happy because, the economy was humming along and they get reelected. Regulators were asleep at the wheel because they see an economy growing. There is always an element of regulatory capture, and it's very hard to be counter-cyclical in your regulatory behavior, spoiling the party while it's occurring. You know, the Fed, instead of taking away the punch bowl, was adding whiskey, cognac, and vodka to it by keeping rates too low for too long. Everybody in the financial system was happy because they were doing gazillions of profits by essentially creating mortgages and from mortgages, RMBSs and from RMBSs, CDOs and CDOs of CDOs and CDOs of CDOs of CDOs. You know, everybody in the securitization chain was making a fee and transferring the credit risk somewhere else, right? So people, again, if they knew it was a bubble, they couldn't care less, you know. Starting with your mortgage broker, whose income would be maximized by maximizing the volume of mortgage approved from the bank, he or she was making more money by pushing this stuff to the banks that were underwriting these mortgages, but then repackaging them into RMBSs and making fees out of it and not holding them on their own balance sheet. To the mortgage appraisers who had an incentive to make distorted appraisals, to the investment banks that were packaging the RMBSs into ever more complex CDOs and structured finance, to the mortgage insurance were making fees on that stuff, to the rating agencies, to everybody else in this chain. Everybody was making a fee and creating more tech stuff and transferring eventually the risk to these final investors who were a little bit greedy, a little bit clueless, believed that what was rated AAA was AAA, and they were final holders of this credit risk. And the banks themselves believed so much that the stuff that was toxic was AAA that they held a bunch of it on their own balance sheet as well. And they did not, essentially take it all off, because if they had fully securitized the stuff and took it off balance sheet, they would have not had the losses they did. A lot of that risk was actually held on balance sheet or on off balance sheet through various structures like seeds and conduits that were only formally off balance sheet, but once they unraveled, then because of credit liquidity enhancements, they went back on balance sheet. But again, that has to do with the system of incentive where, excessive risk-taking was to the advantage of individuals and managers and even CEOs.
Professor, this is Alexis. I just wanted to follow up. You mentioned the rating agencies. When was it clear to you that there was a serious problem with the rating agencies and what they were producing as AAA?
Well, to me it was a clear problem for the following reason, there's no way you can take a bunch of dodgy, average triple B, and we're not even triple B, it doesn't have to be worse than that, subprime mortgages, repackaging them, slicing and dicing them, and then derive out of that stuff that is 90% AAA. That's just, first of all, it cannot occur. Secondly, if you're looking at the macro stuff and you were looking at what happened to home prices and you knew there was a bubble, even a 10% correction in home prices, let alone a 20% correction, would imply default rate that would imply that, of course, the equity tranche would be bust, that the mezzanine would be bust, but even the AAA tranches would have serious losses, as it turned out to be the case. So, you know, these guys had models that did not even consider the possibility of home price deflation. It was not even in the model, in the scenario to be considered. So by definition, a flawed analysis that was distorted by the way they were compensated led them to, you know, rate stuff that, first of all, they were clueless about. Two, that if you think about economy-wide housing bust, there was no way that 80 or 90% of those tranches could be rated AAA, given a sensible scenario about a housing downturn.
So when was it transparent to you that it was a problem?
Well, you know, it was already transparent to me that, you know, that, and I wrote explicit, you know, in the summer of 2006, I said, home price is going to fall 20% from the peak, quantity, supply and demand is going to fall 50% from the peak, and we're going to have a nasty recession, much worse than 1991, and we're going to have a good chunk of the banking system going bust, and also Fannie and Freddie are going to go bust. And we'll go bust, in my view, because they were securitizing stuff that was not really prime.
Right.
You know, today, the default rate on prime mortgages, forget about subprime, the default rate on prime mortgages when in states where unemployment rate is 10% or above and where LTVs are above 120% run today at the rate of 18%. So it was obvious there was not just a problem with subprime, Alt-A, and optionals, but even the prime underwriting was not as careful as it should be. So I saw even Fannie and Freddie going back, and that also. So to me it was perfectly obvious already by the summer, but then by December of 2006, if you're looking at the ABX index, certainly the triple B piece of it were already being priced well below par, but then two or three months later, even the double A and triple A stuff started to go below par. So the market was already telling you by March of 07 that even the AAA was actually tranches were at risk. But of course, you know, these guys were happily ignoring it, and their CDO securitization machine kept on trotting the junk out through July when only the collapse of the Bear Stearns Fund finally led people to realize you had a problem. But it was obvious from November of 2006 that you're going to have a disaster in the making into all the subprime RMBSs and related CDOs. But in the interest of all the big players who were still churning the junk, from Merrill to Lehman to Bear Stearns to Goldman Sachs, to keep the stuff going, because you were getting still billions of profits by keep on shoving the stuff out.
Right.
Given that you have such a good record of having predicted some of these things in before they happened, could you also give us your sense now, given that these problems have occurred, how well do you think the federal government thus far has handled the crisis, and what's coming next?
I mean, you know, that's a very important question, but it's a very, very, you know, long one. And, you know, I spent several chapters on my book discussing separately the three key components of the police response. That has been one, monetary easing, two, fiscal easing, and three, backstopping, ring-fencing, or call it bailout of the financial system. You know, my very brief answer is that we learned some of the lessons of the Great Depression and also of Japan in the 90s, and the policy reaction prevented this Great Recession from turning into a Great Depression, because you need to do, whenever there is this problem, you know, you need to ease monetary policy, cut aggressively rates, and when rates are at zero, to move to quantitative easing. That's one thing that was not done between 29 and 33. Money supply contracted, and there was no countercyclical monetary easing, and that led to a disaster. The Great Crash became the Great Depression. Two, you need, in a situation which there is a collapse of private spending, you need a fiscal stimulus by cutting taxes, increasing transfer payments, and increasing government spending. And leaving aside the quality of that stimulus, even if you do it wrong, totally wrong, just the stimulus by itself prevents a collapse of aggregate demand, because private demand, exports, and consumption, and residential investment and capex were collapsing. So if you don't have a stimulus coming from the public sector, that leads to financial disaster. And three, while there is, of course, bailout concerns and moral hazards, in a situation which the financial system is also subject to not just insolvency problems, but also to liquidity problems, doing nothing, creative destruction becomes uncreative destruction, meaning if you let thousands of banks just go bankrupt and you don't backstop them, then you end up like the Great Depression with a total meltdown of the financial system. So, you know, of course, in each one of them, the fine-tuning of how I would have done the backstopping of the financial system or the fiscal stimulus or the monetary would have been at the margin different, but the reality is that the overall response of the U.S. and other countries, monetary stimulus, fiscal stimulus, and backstopping of the financial system was necessary to avoid another Great Depression. And in the fourth quarter of 08 and the first quarter of 09, global economic activity was falling at the rate that looked like a Great Depression. And literally, the fall in output, production, employment, consumption, exports, imports was tracking the one between 1929 and 31, that was the beginning of the Great Depression. So we're risking another Great Depression. So again, I've been critical of specific components and elements of the policy response, but I would say the overall thrust was the necessary one.
Professor, we've heard in our interviews lots of discussion about what the Fed had the power to do, what its authority was, what it saw and didn't see, the disagreements and the assumptions that were made on the board, etc. Is there any question in your mind that the Fed was the watchdog with the authority to have done something? And then I'll ask you, and what could they have done?
Well, you know, my view of it is that what happened during this financial crisis was the mother of all bank runs, and not just the runs on the traditional banking system, but a bigger run on the shadow banking system, because it's created because of this greater regulation of banks and the emergence of shadow banks, institutions that look like banks because they were borrowing short, actually shorter term than banks through overnight repos. They were leveraged like banks, actually more leveraged than banks, and they were lending in ways that were more illiquid and more longer term than banks. And unlike banks, they did not have the two elements that prevent runs on traditional banks, that is, one, deposit insurance, and two, lender of last resort support, that are the two key innovations that we created, you know, after the creation of the Fed and after the Great Depression to avoid self-fulfilling bank runs. And what happened was literally a generalized run on the entire shadow banking system. First, the non-bank mortgage lenders, hundreds of them went bust when wholesale financing collapsed, then sieves and conduits, then hedge funds, then broker dealers, and by the time of Lehman, money market funds, and even the corporate bond market, the CP essentially had a massive roll-off. So you had literally the equivalent of a generalized run on the entire financial system. And therefore, given that, what the Fed effectively did was two things, was to extend the umbrella of lender of last resort support, not just to traditional banks, but also to first primary dealers and more extensively then broker dealers, and by the time of Lehman, even non-financial corporates, once you had the roll-off of the CP stuff, and even the money markets, and to extend then the degree of deposit insurance more broadly to the banking institution and then even to money market funds, because there was a risk of a run even on those. So in some sense, you know, you could argue how much the Fed may have overused, if not abused, its power to provide lender of last resort support to non-banking institutions. But we were lucky that the Fed had that power and authority, because if it had been up to Congress to temporize and spend months to figure out who to support, then we would have had a collapse of the financial system. So we had one institution that essentially used its power through, you know, their being able to qualified majority vote to extend a variety of liquidity supports and other types of facilities to prevent essentially a generalized run on the shadow banking system. Otherwise, we would have had the Great Depression over again. So it's a lesson on the future that you know, that if you have a shadow banking system, either you regulate it properly to avoid this risk, or otherwise you're going to have a disaster. And I'm not sure that lesson has been learned.
And let me ask you to back up then. While the shadow banking system was developing and while the bubble was inflating, what could the Fed have done, or should it have done?
Well, you know, the shadow banking system evolved for the last 20, 30 years because, you know, we regulated banks, and given that the capital and liquidity constraints, a lot of financial intermediation started to grow outside of the traditional banks in the various elements of the shadow banking system, from, as I said, non-bank mortgage lenders to broker-dealers to sieves and conduits to hedge funds to private equity funds to money market funds. And as I pointed out, all of them look like banks in terms of borrowing short and leveraging and lending long, actually more so than banks. 90% plus of financing of investment banks is to overnight repo. So it's a crazy system when you finance yourself with overnight money and then you leverage three times as much as banks and you invest in ways that are illiquid and much more long term. You know, in February of 2008, I wrote a piece where I said that in the next 2 years, all the independent broker-dealers will disappear in the U.S. and a couple of major ones would go bust. And people thought I was crazy, but it didn't take 2 years for this to happen. It took 7 months, right?
Where did you write that?
7 months for Bear.
Excuse me,
this was in February of 2008.
And where? What publication?
I mean, I can send you the link to it. But the logic was very simple, you know. You had a system of broker-dealers that looked like banks, but they were just worse than banks because they were more leveraged and borrowing more short-term and investing where they were more illiquid. And it was an accident to happen, the unraveling and a run on them. So I said two of them are going to go bust, and all the other ones are going to end up not being any more independent. And guess what? Bear and Lehman went bust. Merrill was taken over by Bank of America, and the other two survived only because they converted into bank holding companies. So again, I was wrong. It took 7 months, not 2 years, to have the entire traditional system of broker dealers essentially disappear from the United States, with the five remaining ones essentially either going bust or essentially completely radically changing.
But
to me, it was wrong. You know, and I wrote extensively, and this was just before Bear, how you have step by step. I had this piece called in March of 2008, 12 Steps to a Financial Disaster, where I explained step by step how you have an unraveling of first non-bank mortgage lenders, then citizen conduits, then broker dealers, then hedge funds, then money market funds. I saw it coming because it was obvious that it was going to happen. You'll have a generalized run on the financial system. Given that all these institutions look like banks and did not have either deposit insurance or lender last resort support. So it was going to happen.
But I guess my question is, should the Federal Reserve have seen what you saw? Should they have seen it coming during the run-up of the bubble itself?
I mean, these were the changes that occurred not over 2 or 3 years, but over the last 20 years. There has been a radical shift of the financial system and the emergence of a shadow banking system, and that was unstable because of what I explained.
Right.
Two, it put a huge amount of pressure on the banks themselves to become more risky. And three, through the repeal of Glass-Steagall, it became fuzzy what was a commercial bank, what was a broker-dealer, because they became components of the same financial supermarket. So So, you know, the same incentive to excessive leverage and poor underwriting, and the entire switch from originate to hold and hold to originate distribute with all the distortion in securitization, because you are not holding any of the credit risk or little of it, became systematic aspect of the financial system.
So you're saying...
But these were the things that were occurring for the many years in the making, and it took then a huge bubble to then lead to the bust of the system.
But are you saying that then, if it took so long to develop, there's no excuse for them not to have seen it?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I saw it coming. Other people like Raghu Rajan were warning about similar things. And, you know, Steve Roach and Ken Rogoff and David Rosenberg and Nassim Taleb and plenty of others saw different pieces of these of overall creation of financial instability, Bill White at BIS, and there have been people who have been warning about these things for 10, 15 years. And, you know, and it took, you know, a massive housing, and it was not just subprime, it was subprime, near prime, prime, and it was not just mortgages, it was also consumer credit and overall, you know, LBOs and you name it, various aspects of a credit bubble that we can generalize that led to a bubble that once bust would have led to a systemic collapse of this entire financial system.
You just mentioned quite a list of people who all had warned and been proven accurate about what happened. Do you know whether the Fed has reached out to any of you to get your interpretations or suggestions on how to deal with the problems now? Have you been contacted?
Sorry,
by
you the last part of-
Have you been contacted by
you
any?
What?
Have you given that you have you given a list of about 8 people that were prescient in predicting what was going to come, in seeing the problems, in seeing the interconnections that were going to cause this collapse. Now we're living with the collapse. Given that you have this record, has anyone from the federal government reached out to you or the other colleagues that you mentioned who made similar warnings, asking for advice or guidance about how to handle the problems now?
You know, I mean, I'm in touch, and from time to time I meet, you know, with policy authorities. You know, I used to be in the U.S. government between 1998 and 2000, during the Clinton administration, first as a senior economist for international economics at the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Then I was for a year at the U.S. Treasury as a senior advisor to Tim Geithner, who at that time was the Undersecretary for International Affairs, and I've known Larry Summers, who at that time was Secretary of the Treasury in 2000, since my time in grad school. When I go to Washington these days, I meet with Tim, Larry, Ben Bernanke, Trichet, and you name it, when I'm in Frankfurt. So, you know, people listen. I would say no individual has the power or influence of affecting complex policy decisions on, for example, how to reform the system of regulation and supervision of the financial system. You know, I've written extensively several chapters of my book, many others have written. My overall view of Dodd-Frank is too little too late and is not going to avoid the next bubble and crisis, and I think it was a missed opportunity to have a much more radical overhaul of the financial system, but I did not assume or expect that just because I got it right that, you know, the thing will change radically. You know, there's a political economy of any legislation or any financial reform where, financial interests and others have their own say. And therefore, no individual has the power or the influence of affecting more than a margin that debate. Well, at most, you can write your views, and people can listen to you. But I never had the presumption of believing that people are going to follow my advice.
You know, but the fact that you knew those people personally, that you were writing strong warnings about what was happening, that now we're being told that they have no memory of any warnings, that it was just a perfect storm that hit them. It's untrue, is what you're telling us.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who is saying what, because I'm not privy to what they might be saying in private. So, you know, I don't know which individuals thought what about whether this was a perfect storm. You know, I know the term perfect storm was used by former Vice President Dick Cheney in some interview, saying this has been a perfect storm, and a few other people have said so. I don't know, I mean, I'd worked with somebody like, say, like Tim Geithner during the time when he was in the Treasury, you know, as an undersecretary. And, you know, he knew a lot about financial crisis in emerging markets, and then when he left, he went to head the PDR department, the IMF, but he was dealing with emerging market crisis. And when he was chosen to run the New York Fed, I jokingly said that, you know, he was the right person because we will have a financial crisis in the U.S. and he was, how to say, knowledgeable as anybody else about financial crisis and to deal with them. And I have to give him credit, actually, if you read the first five, speeches that the team wrote when he was president of the New York Fed, he was warning about lots of things. He was warning about systemic risk in the financial system, about the role of CDSs and counterparty risk. He was worried about our fiscal deficit being unsustainable. He was worried about current account deficit at a time when Ben Bernanke was a little more Panglossian about many of these risks. So I think the team was aware of many of them, and in small measure he was trying to do things that tried to control some of those risks while he was running the New York Fed. So he saw some of those vulnerabilities, but maybe he was too junior, having just joined the board, to be able to more radically influence some of the views. So I think some of them were very smart, and they knew that there was a lot of trouble that was building up. I don't think that they were all clueless. Some people were more clueless. Other people, like Tim Geithner, were not as clueless, and we were actually writing and saying even in public certain things. But, you know, as I said, this build-up is something that is 20 years of financial deregulation, of a rise of the shadow banking system, of you know, a housing bubble that started in 1996 and got out of hand over the next decade, of a bigger credit bubble that enveloped not just housing, but, you know, things from private equities to LBOs to consumer finance to, you name it. I mean, it was not just... it was not a subprime mortgage problem. It was a subprime financial system. So you know, was something that, you know, was a tsunami that by the point by 2003 and 2004, I think that most of the damage was done. The only issue was when the crash would occur. I think the damage had been done for a long time before then. And of course, things got out of hand in the last 2 years of it. But. But this was not just something that you could have stopped in 2004 or 5.
So here we are at the end of 2010. Can you summarize your outlook for where the U.S. economy is now and how long it's going to take to dig out, and then the global economy?
Well, you know, my own work, together the one done by the BIS, IMF, and other academics like Rogoff and Reinhardt, suggest that the economic recovery out of any balance sheet driven recession and crisis, this is not your typical recession, it's a typical, you know, boom and bust, is more like a crisis that was driven by a massive amount of financial imbalances, first in the private sector and now to the fiscal response in the public sector. So usually that implies many years of subpar, anemic, below trend economic growth, what people refer to as a U-shaped recovery, as opposed to the typical V-shaped recovery and return to high potential growth or above potential growth. So it's a U rather than a V in the U.S. and most advanced economies at best. And I would say that's at best because there is a residual risk of a double deep recession, of a W, or even worse, of ending up like Japan with a decade-long economic stagnation, more like an L. So I think the V is out of the window. You are lucky it's going to be an anemic U recovery, and there is a tail risk of a double-deep W or even an L near depression. That's how I would assess the risk for the U.S., for most of the Eurozone, with exception of maybe Germany, and for Japan. So for most advanced economies, there are a few exceptions. It's going to be a very, very anemic and subpar recovery. And unemployment stuck close to 10%, 17% including discouraged workers and partially employed workers, is a reflection of that. And in my view, you can again criticize, individual policymakers and the response, but I think that, you could have had Obama as president or McCain or Hillary Clinton. I think the economy will be exactly the way it is right now, regardless of who's going to be, who has been in power. Because I think that the overall forces of deleveraging would have implied that the outcome would have been the same. I know that the political body tends to then blame incumbents for whatever, and you can have agreements or disagreements on those issues, but I look at it from a macroeconomic financial point of view, and I believe that, the policy response all in all was the one that was necessary and avoidable, and anyone in power would have done pretty much variants of the same. After all, the bailout of financial institutions started in the Bush administration, right? The bailout of Bear Stearns, the bailout of Fannie and Freddie, the $700 billion of TARP, and all the other dozens of financial support schemes that the Fed, the FDIC, and Treasury concocted. They started under the Bush administration, and our budget deficit was already close to $1 trillion by the time Obama came to power. So Obama inherited the worst financial crisis and the worst economic recession since the Great Depression, on top of two foreign wars. So compared to what could have happened, another Great Depression, I would say we're lucky that there is a recovery, however tentative it is, and we're lucky that actually stock market today is 60 or 70% above the bottom at the beginning of that administration. So people tend to forget what the alternative could have been. It would have been much worse. I don't think it could have been any better. I think the alternative would have been much worse under any scenario. So we're lucky that we got this tentative anemic recovery. That's the best we can ask for, because the cost of deleveraging of the private and public sector is going to be painful and it's going to occur for years. And it's not going to be pleasant.
Thank you, Professor, for that cheery ending.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time. Yeah. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pleasure talking with all of you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.